What does the Italian mob have to do with the world's most rare bear population?
The mafia, likely the Camorra, has found a way to subsidize or to sluice EU funds from European Union subsidies to run cattle on the national parklands of Italy. And in doing so, they are threatening the bear population in Abruzzo National Park.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Roger Thompson about his book, No Word for Wilderness, Italy's Grizzlies and the Race to Save the Rarest Bears on Earth. So this book is about the Abruzzo bears. I'm going to be a little nitpicky off the start, Roger, because
great.
I just met with Doug Chadwick last year,
sure.
who claims that the Gobi Grizzlies are the rarest bears on Earth.
Yes.
And I want you to make a claim for the Abruzzo bears and why it matters.
Yeah. So, and Doug's probably right, maybe, somewhere in between. It depends on how we want to take the counts.
Okay.
The official count on the Abruzzo bears is basically between 45 and 50. You talk to a lot of the people in the area, and the number is probably under 40, in which case I think the case is pretty clear that we're dealing with some of the bears. The Gobi bears are really different also, though, and they are under similar pressures. And certainly Doug has made the point that it's very similar, right, that something needs to be done soon with those bears as with the Abruzzo bears.
One of the more shocking bits of information is that these bears are located 50 miles outside of Rome,
yes.
and they're brown bears.
Yes.
How did you get involved in this project?
Well, what you just said is exactly why I got involved in it. The first time I heard about this, I was actually I was on a hike with a friend on the border of Banff National Park and Assiniboine Provincial Park, and we ran into a woman who told me about these bears, and I just kind of refused to believe it. I had to put my eyes on the animals in the region. I mean, so close to Rome. And I mean, saying that bears are in Italy alone is interesting. You know, you immediately think of the Alps, and there are bears in the Alps. But for me, the really kind of striking thing that just within just a short drive, you can go from Rome, where you've seen kind of the heart of a lot of Western civilization and human achievement, but you can actually be in a kind of wild place with these amazing bears that are evolutionary oddities.
And the title of the book is No Word for Wilderness, and you reiterate, as other writers have, that Italy has no word for wilderness. Mm-hmm. So what's the significance of that, and specifically as it relates to your work?
Yeah, so, you know, Italy is not the only culture not to have a word for wilderness, but in terms of Italy, I think it's really an important distinction to make because we associate Italy with human achievement, the rise of the great arts, the rise of civilization, the establishment of some of the first kind of large metropolises. And so the idea there that nature was at some point in ancient time already being obliterated, at least effaced in the way that we would think of it as Americans, right? Where in our culture, we have space in the American imagination for wild places, for wilderness. This idea resonates with lots of us, even if we don't want to take trips to parks or go investigate animals. We know that there's a history here. Even if you think of our old arts traditions like Hudson Valley School, you know, the writing of Muir and Thoreau and others, there's a strong tradition here. But in Italy, that is largely absent. So the problem then, of course, is how do you make the case for wild animals in a culture that may not have a word that represents the world they live in, right? And what part of the case I'm trying to make with the book, or part of what I'm trying to at least prompt people to think about, is that maybe maybe at this point we need to start rethinking what it means to be in the wild, to be in nature. And maybe the Italian parks give us some sort of clue how to go about doing that. This is not to valorize the parks, but to say, look, these bears have persisted 50 miles from Rome against all odds, and there aren't many left, but they have. And the local population there has years ago, a millennia ago, made peace with these bears. If we could figure that out here, then some of the debates we have here with such rancor, I think, probably could be mitigated.
What did you learn about the mythology of bears in the Italian and maybe even in the German mindset?
Yeah. So bears are a love-hate relationship with humans. I mean, you know, on the one hand, they're national symbols for countries, for states, California on the flag. I mean, you know, we're in grizzly territory here. They loom large in the imagination, and we love them in some ways, or at least a lot of people do. But on the other hand, they're terrifying, right? They're apex animals, right? And it really doesn't take much being around in bear country and being aware that you're in bear country to realize that you are not the ultimate creature, right? Yeah, you may have a gun at some point, but the fact that you're carrying that suggests that maybe you're not equipped to handle the animal on your own. So the Italian bears, the Italian culture, it's not entirely dissimilar. I mean, the bears in Abruzzo, they have this kind of, they have an expression, they call them father bear, and there's this notion of them as this kind of paternalistic overseer of the Apennine Mountains. On the other hand, people still, you know, respected them and kept their distance. In Germany, on the other hand, where the bears had been extirpated until 2006, when an Italian bear managed to wander into the country, that notion there of control of nature, control, yes, you had beautiful Bavarian mountains, but they must be tamed. That is a mindset that is pervasive across lots of communities. So yes, you can have bears, but only if they're in controlled settings. What do we do if we give that up? I mean, what if we said, no, we can have bears and they can be where they need to be and we can be alongside of them?
You've brought up Bruno.
Yes.
We have to talk about him.
Yes.
So Bruno's a Slovenian bear, which is different than Abruzzo bear, but yeah, was from Italy and wandered into Germany. And what is he accused of, or what was he accused of?
Accused is the right word also. So yes, Bruno was born to a Slovenian sow, and who was part of a very aggressive and successful rewilding program attempting to bring brown bears back to the Alps, and in this case, the Italian Alps. It was a wildly successful program in Austria and Italy, but then the bears ran afoul of people, and part of the way that ran afoul was with one bear in particular. His name was Bear JJ1, and he became labeled later on by the German media Bruno the Bear. Bruno in 2006 wandered into Bavaria, became the first wild bear in Germany in 150 years, and it happened to be the time that Germany was also hosting the World Cup. Germany, a nation proud of efficiencies and control and well-oiled machines, didn't know how to handle a wild bear. And in fact, one of the things we learned from the WikiLeaks document leaks was that the U.S. State Department found this very interesting and got very involved in kind of observing and taking notes and commenting on how German officials handled this kind of what they pitched as a rampaging bear in Bavaria. They saw it as a way to understand German mindset in response to media bad news stories. And the Germans did not respond well to this bear in general. You know, I should say certain German organizations did not. And ultimately, they ordered the bear killed.
So Bruno is not one of the bears that this, your particular book, is about. And yet, you spend time with Bruno. Mm-hmm. And so can you draw an explicit line between why you needed to include him in the book and also talk about Abruzzo bears?
Yes. What I wanted to point out was that there's multiple reasons. Primary, I wanted to point out the distinction between a bear that has evolved to the particular region it's in. And here's the key point. Not just the bear has evolved to them being around, but the people have grown up and lived with these bears and know them and understand them, versus people who are part of the rewilding program by whether their choice or not, right? The rewilding program brings these Slovenian bears in the north of Italy and in the Alps. There was a native population of brown bears there. They had been over the years killed and hunted and died out. In the 90s, there are three of them left. In 2001 or two, the last one died. So the cultural imagination there, the social structure that once supported the notion of bears, if it was ever there in the same way it was in Abruzzo, and I'm not convinced it was, after all, the native population died out. But the changes in that area around tourism, ski slopes, everything else, that was not a bear-friendly habitat, at least in some respects. We shouldn't forget that one of the fundraising arms for Silvio Berlusconi's group had an illegal bear dinner fundraiser for Berlusconi in the north of Italy using some of these bears. So this was not a friendly bear territory. So part of what I want to do is show this contrast between the bears that are reintroduced and what it means for that culture to try to reimagine their lives with them versus the Abruzzo bears, where that has a millennia of cohabitation. Now, granted, that's changing, and that's part of the threat, is that the new people coming to Abruzzo, which aren't a lot, it's a very poor area, but the ones who are coming are largely vacationers, people seeking maybe even second homes, sometimes Europeans, otherwise just from Italy. And they don't have the history of living alongside the bear. It's not the same thing. And so the question is whether the bears can persist despite that.
One of the more interesting concepts that I came across in your book in terms of land use and public land use is Italy's concept of uso civico. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Yeah, it's a really powerful, and especially for Americans, this may sound a surprise. There is the idea with the uso civico is that it originated in ancient Roman times, where the poor were allowed to go onto noblemen's lands and use a bit of it for, say, firewood. So this was not popular among the nobles, but was wildly popular among the plebeians. This idea has carried forward to today, whereas in America we have this great sense of private property. We like our fences. We like knowing that we own the land. In Italy, an Italian citizen can go onto a national park land, can go onto any park land, can go onto a neighbor's land, and if there's need, civic need, for that person to survive the winter, they need wood or they need a little plot of land to grow some vegetables to survive through hard times, they are allowed to do so, okay? You can imagine how this could create certain loopholes. And in the national park system, there are some bad actors who are using this loophole to, in particular, run cattle on the national parks. And that is a big problem.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Roger Thompson about his book, No Word for Wilderness: Italy's Grizzlies and the Race to Save the Rarest Bears on Earth. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, we'll talk more about the mafia, blue snow, and how a horse could give birth to a rhino. Thinking about the book as a whole, it reads part as natural history lesson, part mystery, part sci-fi. In terms of the more thrilling elements, can you talk about blue snow?
I can talk about blue snow. There's a photographer in Italy by the name of Bruno D'Amici, and Bruno is a highly accomplished wildlife photographer, internationally kind of regaled. Bruno was out taking pictures one day and went up a trail and found and was getting to higher elevations and noticed a spot of really stunningly bright, even beautiful blue azure snow. But he knew it wasn't normal. He'd been enough in nature to think, well, that's weird. He knew better than to mess around with it, though he wanted to somehow take a sample of it somewhere. what it turned out to be, he went back and described it to some of the naturalists, and what it is a poison, a cocktail of some sort, left oftentimes on carcasses to poison animals in the park. In Italy, poisoning wild animals was legal till 1976 or something. The people who are now running cattle inside the parks continue to poison carcasses. They say because in this case, bears or wolves attack their animals. There's a chance that the wolves are. The bears are absolutely not. And yet the poison doesn't distinguish. As one of the journalists there, Fede Di Leonardo, points out, since 2002, there's been nearly 40 poisonings of bears inside the parks or at the park boundaries. That's a big number for bears that only number around 50.
I was thinking earlier when you said that these Abruzzo bears have persisted, and I'm also thinking that the mafia has persisted. Can you draw a parallel between those two versions of wildness?
What a lovely question. I can feel within me a kind of resistance to that question simply because the type of wildness is different, right? The kind of one is lawlessness. The other one is living without law or living to a law that we have decided to forget, which is kind of a kind of realm of nature, right? So one flies in the face of that, one doesn't. Having said that, the mafia is implacable, and whether you can unseat that, I don't think there's any doubt you can unseat a species. I mean, our species, humans, have been awfully efficient at eradicating others. So maybe there's a parallel there, but it makes me nervous to think of that.
Sure. Yeah. I'll ask it a different way, because sure. You have a chapter entitled Rewilding the Mob.
Yeah.
So describe that.
Yeah, that was an attempt to... So there's a wonderful organization called Rewilding Europe that's trying to think about what it means to have wild places in settled lands. And a lot of their efforts are dedicated to places that are somewhat wild still. And they've regained a footprint in Abruzzo. In fact, I've just read that they've signed an agreement to kind of return and force there, which is great. There was an attempt, in fact, Bruno D'Amici was part of this. There was an attempt to do a deal with the mafia. And that's not how it'd be pitched. It was a deal with the cattle ranchers. And the deal was the rewilding had gotten enough money to pay for the relocation of the cattle within Abruzzo National Park. They had enough money to build them whole new barns, fences, everything. And they were going to pay for all of it in order to protect one particular very important valley to these bears where cattle roam constantly. And everything seemed signed and delivered. And it was as though somehow there was an agreement that, okay, we can respect this space. Of course, despite verbally agreeing, when it came down to signing the papers, the cattle ranchers didn't show up. And in fact, when questioned about it, they said, well, we can't, you know, the cows like this valley. If they get out of the pens, they're going to go themselves back to it as though it's not their job to keep them within the fences, right? It's as though the cows are wild animals that can't be controlled in some sort of way. And so it ultimately crumbled, right? And in that way, the mob couldn't be rewilded, right? There was an earnest attempt to meet them on their own terms, which is financial, strictly financial. They weren't going to try to stop them from running cattle. They were going to just put it in a different place. So the profits would have still been there. But for whatever reason, and to me it's probably just an exercise of power and authority, they didn't come to the table when they said they would.
I want to move to the sci-fi part of the book. There are a few lines in here that read like a Frankenstein poem. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read them, and then I'll ask you a question.
Great.
A goat might give birth to a sheep might give birth to a dog, a horse might give birth to a rhino. So can you talk about cloning as it relates to the Italian grizzlies?
Yeah, so one of the interesting side stories that I never expected to discover, much like I should point out the mafia connection. I had no clue any of that would ever. I honestly didn't believe it until I started putting the pieces together. In this case also, there was a gentleman by the name of Lino Loy, who's at university there in Teramo, and he's on kind of the forefront of cloning technology, and he's very interested in what some people call de-extinction, right? Which is kind of the resurrecting of animals that have gone extinct. And his is not a kind of Jurassic Park, find an insect in amber type of thing. Instead, what he's saying is, look, we have these rare species now. Why don't we collect some of their DNA, some of their genetic material, and preserve it so that when we have the technology, we can bring them back. And what he's working on is the actual technology to bring them back. And what he has investigated and is working on pretty actively is animals that you may have a couple left of, right? A rhino that you may have one or two left, but are sterile. So how do you give birth to, how do you bring that back? They're not completely gone yet. You got one left, right? How do you bring it back? What carries this rhino to term? And so what he's looking at is which species can carry other species. And he's developed a process through a group of scientists, and he's in the process of having certain animals give birth to another species by inserting the DNA into carrying essentially a host.
One of the lines you walk in the book is not just the human wild animal relationship, but the human to domesticated animal to wild animal relationship. And I really want you to read a passage about my favorite canine breed, the Maremma sheepdog.
Yes. This comes from a chapter in which we're talking about the idea of the nature tax. In Abruzzo, the Abruzzo people, the Abruzzese, have over time developed this idea that if you live in bear territory, you pay a tax to nature, and in that case, to Father Bear. So if you own a orchard, you would plant an extra tree at the boundary of your property, and that was the bear's. If you have a apiary, you put an extra hive at the edge of your property, and that's the bear's. And everyone seemed to agree with this arrangement. At the same time, you have other domesticated species that are brought in to work in and around the bears, and it was largely actually for the wolves that the Maremma sheepdog appeared. And so I'll read a little bit about that sheepdog. Maremma sheepdogs are notoriously independent and rugged, yet remarkably gentle. They are large and look like an albino Newfoundland or a pure white Pyrenean mountain dog. Able to make long traverses with their herds, today they frolic across the valleys and mountaintops of Abruzzo, apparently free of their guard duties. They are, by reputation, fearless and willful, devoted to their owners, and, above all else, their herds. This native dog stands as the great guardian of the region, and his distinctive role in shaping the cultural history of the area should be seen as just as important as the role of the bears in shaping the identity of the region. They are ubiquitous, they are unmistakable, and they are, after a good wash of their thick coat, perfectly charming. Italians, betraying their ongoing pride in regional history, insist that Maremmas raised in one valley are distinct from those in the neighboring valley or from the neighboring hilltop town. Each little corner of Abruzzo, locals insist, has its own breed of Maremma, perfectly adapted to that spot in the mountains. The breed purportedly extends back to Roman times and has been a crucial part of the Pax Romana between animal and human in central Italy. Generations of shepherds have lived peacefully with the bears and wolves, knowing that some small portion of their herds may be lost to scavenging beasts, but that the rest were well protected by the loyal Maremma. The result? Not just peace, but also pride. The Abruzzese tout their relationship with the land and animals as central to their character. They have reached a delicate balance, one whose foundation is respect for the power of the bears and wolves in the area, even while they demand their own respect. The Maremmas represent this desire for respect, even if it also represents the truce struck between man and beast. It represents human adaptation to nature, a willingness to accommodate, even if only to a certain degree. The dog embodies a long-standing peace, forged over generations, paid for by the offerings of goodwill, and it represents long-standing pride in what is possible if humans work with animals and not against them. They represent balance, even if a tentative one, and their pervasiveness is a sign of health of the region. Yet today, the Maremmas are declining in Abruzzo, and they are seen with increasing frequency wandering village alleys and valley byways instead of the mountainsides and high grazing lands. They tend to smaller flocks, fewer sheep, and come down from the mountains to lounge on street curbs and scavenge for food and trash bins. On any given night, a vagrant pup might play in Pescasseroli's central square, chewing a crackling plastic bottle it plucked from roadside waste. They are restless, and they are signaling to anyone who will listen that the delicate balance between man and beast has been tipped in favor of man. They are telling us that the great peace has finally come to an end.
If the great peace has come to an end, what do you see as the fixative?
Yes, so from my perspective, as an American trying to understand the plight of these Italian bears, the only remedy is international action. I don't see how the bears persist as long as they have. I don't see them going another 1,000 years without international action. And so my hope is that this book brings a little bit of ruffling, a pebble in the water, right? That it somehow, the circle reaches out to just the right person who knows exactly what to do. I mean, I want to be part of that, right, in terms of trying to help people understand and see the relationships between ourselves and other large animals. And it's enough for me for that. But it's not enough in terms of the Italian bears. There's got to be action. And certainly there is a great sense of pride in Italy around these bears, but it's a convenient pride. It's a pride that shows up only when something bad is happening, and then people want to rush to the defense. It's momentary, it's highly circumstantial, you know, and some contingency gives rise to outrage. And there are people working persistently, right? The best organization I can speak of is Salvioma and Lorso, you know, Let's Save the Bear. They are a wonderful organization, grassroots, working very hard, but have almost no resources. The only way that changes for the bears, that the defenders, the people who might make a difference, is through more international awareness and activity.
Roger Thompson currently lives in New York. His first book, a co-authored Iraq War memoir, was an award-winning bestseller that was covered by the New York Times, NPR, and the CBC, among others. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.